The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to a Wednesday. It is Wednesday. I'm Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at 5 Eastern, 2 Pacific, at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network. We stream video on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and Facebook and wherever else we can. You know, I'm just looking at the YouTube chat room, and Zenny who said, I'm pissed. I missed yesterday. I love Nicole's music shows. My bad. Melanie was here yesterday. Melanie Safka. I never knew her real name, her last name, until this week. But Melanie, lay down. Candles in the I keep wanting to say candles in the wind, not candles in the wind. Candles in the air. Lay down, candles. Roller skate. Look what they done to my song, Ma. And she was every bit as charming as I'd hoped she would be. But so Zenny said, "I'm pissed. I missed yesterday." Well, the show is not behind a paywall, and we have archives galore. You can go to the website, NicoleSandler.com, under yesterday's date, which would be /8-8-17-21, and you'll get yesterday's show. The audio podcast is posted there, the video podcast. I think the YouTube version is embedded, and I even embedded the videos that I played on yesterday's show, even the one that almost got me copyright violated. What happened, just so you know, Miley Cyrus went over to Melanie's house and did a backyard jam session. It wasn't a concert. I mean, it was just them. And they did a few songs, and it was wonderful. It was really impressive. And I started playing their duet of, Look What They Done to My Song, Ma. And a notice came up on the software that streams to YouTube that said, "Warning, warning, danger, Will Robinson. You have a, you're playing copyrighted information, copyrighted material. Stop now or we're going to, you know, kill your broadcast," basically. So I potted it down. Well, that was Miley Cyrus's label. That's Sony Music who did that. Thankfully, though, they pulled the video down off of Facebook because Facebook saw copyrighted material. YouTube did what they most often do, which is give me a notification of a content match. It's not a copyright strike, but it, you know, when you go to the YouTube video and you see a commercial, the pennies in revenue that it would give to me, Sony Music takes. That's how it works. So that's fine. It's not like I get rich by the ads they play on YouTube. So anyway, that's that. The point is, though, that the shows are archived. I don't have a paywall. Go back and watch. Melanie was just wonderful. She was just charming. Here's a woman who was 22 years old at Woodstock, which blows my mind because my kid is now 22. And I looked at Melanie on stage at Woodstock. It's like, wow, that she's Allison's age there. And now she's, what, 74? And still performing and still singing and making music and just a beautiful soul. So I had never met her before, and it was a treat. So anyway, there's that. Now today, back to reality. Not that yesterday wasn't reality, but, you know, Afghanistan. Things are just crazy, right? So I'm reading, you know, and I mentioned this yesterday, how the media is all over Biden. Now, look, I get that the withdrawal was messy. It was ugly. It still is. It's horrible. And the worst thing about it are all the people who are left behind, who the Taliban will go after, will kill, will rape, will do unimaginable things to. We need to get them out of there. We should have done that before this withdrawal, period. So that was an epic screw up. In fact, just about an hour ago or less, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense held a briefing. They took some questions. They spoke about what happened. And I'm not going to play a whole lot of it for you. I'm just going to play this clip. This is Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, basically saying nothing we saw indicated that Kabul would fall that quickly.
Let me make one comment on the intelligence, because I'm seeing all over the news that there are warnings of a rapid collapse. I have previously said from this podium and in sworn testimony before Congress that the intelligence clearly indicated multiple scenarios were possible. One of those was an outright Taliban takeover following a rapid collapse of the Afghan security forces and the government. Another was a civil war, and a third was a negotiated settlement. However, the time frame of a rapid collapse, that was widely estimated and ranged from weeks to months and even years following our departure. There was nothing that I or anyone else saw that indicated a collapse of this army and this government in 11 days.
Nothing indicated this collapse within 11 days. Yesterday, the National Security Advisor, Tom Sullivan, also gave a briefing, and here's a little bit of what he said.
The United States made an extraordinary sacrifice in Afghanistan.
I should mention, this was in response to a question from a journalist who said, well, the United States really didn't make any sacrifices in this war, to which Tom Sullivan took a bit of exception.
The United States made an extraordinary sacrifice in Afghanistan. 2,448 Americans lost their lives in Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of Americans were injured in the war in Afghanistan over 20 years, trying to help that country stand up and be able to defend itself.
That is very true. Yes.
The United States spent more than $1 trillion of its resources.
$2 trillion.
The amount of sacrifice and solidarity and commitment to Afghanistan, to trying to give it a chance, was immense.
Yes,
and it wasn't
just
the United States. Many other countries joined us and had their own sacrifice. Excuse me. Let me just finish answering the question. And so the idea that there was a lack of sacrifice on the part of the American people is belied by the rows of headstones over at Arlington National Cemetery where people have come home.
Yeah, I don't know how anyone could say that we didn't sacrifice. Then again, because we didn't have a draft, that this was a war that, you know, people who needed to enlist did. But those privileged few, the sons and daughters of the elite, did not, for the most part. But that's that. You know, I started talking about this yesterday, but I'm going to mention it again, that the media has gone overboard in condemning President Biden. And yes, were mistakes made? Obviously, the intel sucked. How they didn't know that Kabul would fall that quickly, that's a big problem. But I applaud Biden for doing what four presidents didn't do, getting us out of Afghanistan. Because after 20 years, the last thing we needed to do was be there again. Or remain there and go on for another 5, 10, 20 years, right? But then there are people, and I rambled off a list of them yesterday, but one of the most egregious is a guy that I cannot stand anyway, Tom Nichols. He's on Twitter, at Radio Free Tom. The morning jerk people on MSNBC have him on all the time, and I can't with this guy. Well, he wrote a piece in The Atlantic. Here's a quote from it. As comforting as it would be to blame Obama and Trump, we must look inward and admit that we told our elected leaders of both parties that they were facing a no-win political test. What? The headline on the story is, Afghanistan is your fault. The American public now has what it wanted? He's so off base that I'm not even going to justify it. I'm not going to dignify it with any more quotes from that. But I will tell you, Lucas Kuntz, do you remember him? He is a candidate. He's running for the Senate from Missouri. And he tweeted a link to that article. And above it wrote, for decades, elites in both parties said we were winning in Afghanistan. That continued sacrifices were necessary. all lies. Now they're saying that everyday Americans they misled are at fault for two decades of failed political and military leadership. Not them. Another lie. And so then I'm intrigued because Lucas Kuntz is a veteran. He served two tours of duty in Afghanistan and I believe one in Iraq. And now he's running for the Senate. And one of his opponents, well, on the Republican side in the primary, is Eric Greitens. Remember him, the former governor of Missouri who had to resign because of a sex scandal. Well, he's running. And I'm not going to play you the video because he lies through his teeth, but he tweeted a video of himself pushing lies. And he says, as a Navy SEAL, I can tell you what's happening in Afghanistan is a result of Joe Biden's policy of weakness. Under President Trump's peace through strength agenda, America and our allies were safe and secure.
Bullshit.
That is bullshit. Just bullshit. But I got to point out one. I bring up Lucas Kuntz because we're going to talk to him in a moment. Before we get there, though, I want to play this clip. I meant to play it yesterday and never got to it. But Nicole Wallace at MSNBC realized exactly what I did, that the media, for some reason, was putting all the blame on Biden. And here's what she said.
95% of the American people will agree with everything he just said.
Well, Biden's
95%
speech.
Of the press covering this White House will disagree. And for an American president to finally be completely aligned with such an overwhelming majority of what the American people think about Afghanistan is probably a tremendous relief to the American people. He also went a long way toward really fleshing out a Biden doctrine. And there are questions about whether he can achieve what he set out, but there is no equivocation. There is no lack of confidence that this is the right decision. And what he has going for him is a vast majority of Americans in both political parties.
Good for her. Good for her. Well, so I get an email from Lucas Kuntz, who I mentioned is running for the Senate from Missouri. And he writes, some politicians are telling us now isn't the time to speak frankly about Afghanistan. I'm not surprised. For decades, elites told the American people we were winning this war. Later, they told us while Iraq was wrong, Afghanistan was the war worth fighting. They told us it was worth the lives, worth the money, worth the time. It was all lies. Serving there and what I saw when I came home factored heavily in my decision to run for U.S. Senate here in Missouri. I've always said one of the hardest parts of my deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan was coming home to my old neighborhood in Cole County, Missouri. Empty lots, abandoned buildings, a gutted Midwest. Our own communities look like battlefields after decades of economic warfare waged by corrupt politicians and massive corporations. They spent $6.4 trillion in taxpayer dollars sending soldiers like me out to fight on a doomed mission to build up someone else's country because they thought it made them look strong. Then they turned around and told us we can't, quote, afford nation building right here at home. So it's with that as the background and his criticism of Tom Nichols, thank you very much, that I reached out to Lucas Kuntz and asked him to, come back on the show to tell us about this. So I think we have Lucas here. Here we go. I'm thrilled to welcome back to the show Lucas Kuntz. He is running for the U.S. Senate from the state of Missouri. He joined me and Howie Klein on the show just a few weeks ago. And I remembered, Lucas, we talked about the fact that you are a veteran. You fought in Afghanistan and Iraq. And obviously, we know what happened this week. Iraq has fallen to the Taliban. And I've noticed that the criticism seems to all be aimed at Joe Biden, who got us out of the war as he said he would. Now, obviously, the withdrawal was not as flawless as we'd hoped, but is it possible to lose and leave an occupied territory gracefully?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's, people have been really focused on the last 72 hours. Sorry, there's some cars drive by. The last 7 days or so, but mm-hmm. like the real tragedy here is the fact that we were there for 20 years. We spent $2.25 trillion and 2,500 Americans about lost their lives. And like there was no right decision. There was no right way to do this right now. Like the right way to do this passed us by in 2002, 2003, when the Taliban was weak. Mm-hmm. And when we had accomplished what our initial mission was, which was to break them up and get Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan. And so instead we spent, 20 years, all those lives and all that money, providing the Taliban a great opponent to practice against for all that time. And now they're stronger than they ever were. And you saw that the way they just sort of glided right through the country and took things over.
Right. So you actually sent out an email to your list talking about that, the politicians are screaming that this isn't the time to talk honestly about Afghanistan. It actually is. And you were there and you're hitting on the right notes, I think. 20 years. And I think the criticism of Joe Biden, apart from the fact that the leaving of Afghanistan didn't go off without a hitch, I can't think of a war, and we're going to talk with a historian a little later about disruption and change. I don't know that a war has ever ended where all sides are happy. We're leaving a war. We did not win this war, but I don't know that it's possible to win in Afghanistan. What would winning in Afghanistan have looked like?
I mean, I don't think it's really about winning and losing. It was just about accomplishing the mission, and our mission was not supposed to be building a nation, right? Our mission was supposed to be knock out the Taliban, who was harboring Al-Qaeda, and, make it so that it's not a safe haven for Al-Qaeda. And we accomplished that really, really quickly, right?
Really
and
quickly.
Then because a lot of people made money off of it, because politicians wanted to perpetuate this lie, because the mainstream media, to use a term, but like the media decided just not to pay attention to it anymore. And so, that's how we ended up there for 20 years, accomplishing nothing. And honestly, the real tragedy for me is seeing our country and our politicians and the people in control being willing to spend, let's talk about the Middle East as a whole, $6.4 trillion in the Middle East, building countries up over there. I went there three times, friends of mine lost their lives, and not willing to spend 1/6 of that amount right here in America with an infrastructure bill. Like, it's totally perverted, and it only helps them out. And I find it deplorable, and we got to do something about it.
Well, you hit on a really important topic there with the money. Put aside the lives that were lost, that it is horrific. But the money that we spent, you mentioned like $2.5 trillion on Afghanistan alone, over $6 trillion in the Middle East, and Congress, some members of Congress are balking at spending the money that we need to fix up our infrastructure here at home to put people back to work. If we hadn't spent that $6 trillion plus, think of all the things we could have done. We could have universal health care paid for by the government. We could have nice things, but they tell us we can't afford any of it, but yet they have a blank check when it comes to waging war. And they also, one other thing that you mentioned in your letter, in your email, Lucas, is you said for decades we were lied to. We were told that this war was going great. We were doing fine. We were winning, but we were lied to, weren't we?
Yeah. And for anybody on the ground, we knew that. I mean, Iraq's a great example, too. I went to Iraq and I led a police training team there. And so my job was to lead 12 Marines around a few towns there, Hamania, Fallujah, Ramadi, Sakhalawiya, and train the Iraqi police. And when I got there, I got this 25 page PowerPoint deck. We called it stoplight charts. And so what it did was it rated the Iraqi security forces on everything they were supposed to do, like logistics, weapons maintenance, armory, detention operations, all that sort of stuff. And if they were good at it, if they were considered mission capable, it was green. If they were still working on it, the bar would be coded yellow. And if they were, needed a lot of work, it would be coded red. And I remember I got there, I got this, I was like, oh, these guys look pretty good. Lots of green and yellow, not really any red. And then I spent some time with them and I was like, no, these guys can hardly do anything that's on here. And so I asked my higher chain of command, what are we supposed to do about this? I think I need to downgrade them in almost every area. And he says, no. Like, we got direction from higher. We are not allowed to downgrade anybody. And at the end of the tour, they have to go up in at least a few things. And so there was just this systematic institutional dishonesty in the war in Iraq. And you know what happened when we left? They got overrun out there by people in pickup trucks with ISIS. And so you're seeing the same thing in Afghanistan right now. I mean, I went to Afghanistan twice. I was there in 2014 when they were supposed to be, you know, logistically independent. And I was given an emergency mission to make sure that our partnered force out in Western Afghanistan got the food, the ammunition, and everything they needed to get through the fighting season, because they literally could not do it themselves. And so we were lied to about Iraq. We lied to about Afghanistan. I mean, this is like the institutional dishonesty that I think is the biggest concern in our country right now, or at least it should be. I mean, we're lied to about the economy, right? Like
about everything, right?
About everything. And so I'd like to give you an example about that. Like in 2012, my dad was trying to sell the house that I grew up in. He got a mortgage on it in 1988 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Everyone in America would say, oh, the economy is booming. The housing market has recovered. Everybody's doing great. That house sat on the market in Jefferson City, Missouri for 2 years. Wow. He got $43,000 for it and he owed $78,000 on it. And like, that's the story in Missouri where people have been lied to about essentially everything. And so what we have now is a situation where people are so distrustful of the institutions because they've been lied to for so long that, you know, people like Josh Hawley can roll in here with their lies and their BS, and they can keep people from taking vaccines or doing whatever else. And it's just, you know, it's a real shame. And that's where we have to provide a true solid contrast or we're going to lose really what we stand for in our country.
Lucas, you mentioned Josh Hawley there, so I should mention here that this is the seat that you're running for, the seat that he occupies now in the Senate.
I'm not running for it. So we've got an open seat here in Missouri.
Oh.
So it's Roy Blunt's seat.
So you're not running against open. Josh Hawley.
Okay. But Josh Hawley is sort of encapsulates the problem in Missouri where, you know, we've really got the battle for the frontline battle for America's souls going on right here. And the real crux of it is it really is trust. And there's just been so much distrust that's warranted that now nobody believes anything.
It's amazing. And then I will mention somebody who is running on the Republican side is the former governor who was run out of office in a horrible scandal. And Greitens, is that his name?
Yes, Eric Greitens is our disgraced former governor.
Yes. And now he's leading the polls on the Republican side to fill this, as you mentioned, open Senate seat.
Yeah, it's tough. And he is leading the polls. And again, the reason for that is that we have had just such a deeply dishonest discussion in our country about so many things. And we have to change that. So my goal with my candidacy is to really say the hard things, have the honest discussions, and show that we can do this the right way. It doesn't have to be the fake way that the Josh Hawleys and the Eric Greitens are.
Right.
Performing.
But when you talk about lying, there's a video that I saw. I don't know if you tweeted it out or someone else did, of Greitens, you know, talking about what happened in Afghanistan, and he's, you know, placing blame and doing that. I'm not going to play it because it's opposite world. There's nothing factual about it. And I don't like putting out fake information, but he's lying. I don't know if he ever served in the military. You were there when you heard that Joe Biden was going to make good on his campaign promise and pull all the troops out, do it by 9/11. Did you ever have any doubt that the Taliban would come in? Did you think that
absolutely not. No, it was entirely inevitable what happened. And sure, the withdrawal didn't go well. Like I saw a joke saying the only successful withdrawal from Afghanistan was when the president fled with, the president of Afghanistan fled with $169 million in cash.
Right. And couldn't fit it all in the helicopter.
Yeah. And that's right. Couldn't fit it all in the helicopter. But like what that shows me is like the only people who succeeded in this war effort were the elites in America and the elites in Afghanistan, and the normal everyday people in Afghanistan and in America were let down and, you know, suffered because of it.
Now, the big, you know, the thing that I feel, I'm glad we're out of there. We should, as you said, we should have been out of there 18 years ago, if we even should have gone in the first place. And that's a topic for another day. I don't think we should have, but, you know, we'll leave that to another time because we did. But now we have a lot of people who helped us, people that you probably know who are stuck there, and they're targeted by the Taliban because they helped the Americans. We should get them out of there, shouldn't we? What's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, when I think back to my interpreters in Iraq and in Afghanistan, I know that they saved my life on more than one occasion. And yeah, we should be doing everything we can to help them. I think that's why we have troops there again, is to make sure we get them out. And then we need to leave for real and leave for good, because like what my biggest worry is that, you know, with all of the current tragedy that's going on, the last 72 hours or so of tragedy, is that people who want to keep us there forever, keep a war going on, keep us in a warlike state, profit off the defense contracting sort of industrial complex, are going to use this, going to use the humanitarian catastrophe as an excuse to keep us there. And we need to make sure that doesn't happen. That's the number one thing we need to make sure it doesn't happen. Like, we've shown over the last 20 years that the United States military is not going to be able to build a nation there. That's not our job. It's right. Not what we're trained for. It's not what we should be doing. It's expensive and it's a waste of money. We need to use the other tools in the toolbox, diplomacy, you know, international relations, non-government organizations, to sort this situation out on the ground.
You know, I read somewhat a quote from someone who said, you know, the Taliban, for them, it's a passion. It's their religion. It's what they believe. The Afghans who fought with us were doing it for a paycheck. And is that the reason, do you think, that they couldn't, with 20 years of training and the best equipment and money galore, that they couldn't defend themselves? And the other part of it is, did we ever even think about training women, arming women? Because they're the ones who are going to be hurt the most, I think, going forward when after we're completely gone.
I mean, everything there is complex, right? Mm-hmm. The cultural differences are complex, with, you know, gender relations, the Taliban, their motivations, the Afghan National Security Forces. I mean, you kind of see like what the president just did, running out with $169 million, sort of encapsulates what was going on the entire time. Like, a set of elites were taking what they could when they could. And the boots on the ground, the soldier in the Afghan army or in the police forces, you know, they didn't always get all the food they needed. They were under-equipped. They didn't have the ammunition that they needed. A lot of them were very brave and died valiantly. A lot of them protected their families and walked away. You know, a lot of them didn't even exist. They were just paper forces, you know, that someone would claim so that they could get a paycheck for them and steal the pay. And so, you know, there's just a ton of issues here, but the overall lesson, if I could say one overall lesson for
Please.
This,
yes.
for, you know, politicians in America and for everybody else who's sort of in control, it's just don't lie. That's why people aren't getting vaccines right now.
That's right.
They've been lying for forever. And I mean, it's very clear in Afghanistan now that what we were told was a falsehood. And the only people who knew that were people like me who were on the ground.
Lucas Kuntz, I thank you so much for speaking up and speaking truth. I think the last couple of days has been an avalanche of anger aimed at Joe Biden. I don't think he's the one to blame. Yeah, the pullout was ugly, but it always is. And I don't know what anybody else expected, if they thought it was going to be all, you know, it was like, we're going to be greeted with flowers and love. Well, that didn't happen either. So I'm glad you're speaking up. There's a lot of blame to go around. And yeah, and I guess this administration is to blame for not knowing that the Taliban was perfectly capable of coming in a matter of days and just running roughshod. But, you know, to blame all everything on Joe Biden, I think, is misguided. And I'm the last person you'd expect to be defending Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the blame rests with a ton of politicians over a period of 20 years. And you know, yeah, the withdrawal is botched. But the withdrawal should have happened in 2000 or 2003 when the Taliban had no strength. And so for me, it's like we need to look past. Like, everybody's really excited to get focused on the last 72 hours, the last 7 days,
right,
because I think it's easy to point blame. And that really, like, the sadness there is that that distracts from the 20 years of lies and, like, the real tragedy, which is, again, that Americans have fundamentally lost trust in our institutions because of things like this. And we are all paying for it.
We are. Lucas Kuntz, thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. I know you're busy. You're in the middle of a big campaign. I encourage people to go to the website. It's LucasKuntz, KUNCE.com, or follow you on Twitter, Lucas Kuntz, M-O, for Missouri. How's the campaign going?
It's going real well. We're having fun, raising money, meeting a lot of people, just, you know, talking about the honest issues that are going on in an unvarnished way. And I think that's the most important thing that we can do right now, is really just, you know, meet people where they're at and talk to them.
You got it. Thank you again. I appreciate you jumping on today and speaking up. You know, there's no good side to this other than the fact we're out of Afghanistan. That's worth celebrating. The reason we're not celebrating is because there are people still in danger. But otherwise, would you be celebrating?
I mean, I wouldn't put it that way. Like, it's just kind of a grim reality, yeah, for most of us who were there. And we feel like it should have happened a long time ago. And we really hope that, you know, our children don't have to go there. I mean, there are people whose children are there who deployed there previously. Ugh. It's sad that it's multiple generations.
That's what people should be angry about. 20 years, too many lives lost, too much money spent, and we're no better off than we were before we went in.
Absolutely.
Yeah. War. Lucas Kuntz, thank you again. It was great talking to you, and hopefully next time it'll be to celebrate something.
Yeah, thanks. Bye, Nicole. Right.
Lucas Kuntz, he is, I really like him. I hope he wins. If you're in Missouri, he is running in the primary. We would like him to be, you know, the candidate going up against whoever the Republicans wind up putting up. So this is what's happening now in real time. And, well, we have a, now I want to get sort of put it in historical perspective. Right. So we're going to talk to our next guest is just getting ready in the Zoom room. He's written a book. His name is David Potter. He's written a book. I got to get our shot set up because I do everything all at once here. He's written a book called Disruption: Why Things Change. And David Potter. Hold on one second. Let me. I got to figure out my stuff here. What I should probably do. All right. We're getting, you know what? Let me just play while I get our shot set up. Let me share something else with you if I can get it going really quickly. This is the hard part, segueing from one to another. I want to share with you a report from on the road from Kabul. We've seen Clarissa Ward on CNN. Have you seen her? Her reports are just mind-blowing. Well, Richard Engel is the foreign correspondent for NBC News, and he's been doing a really great job as well covering what's going on the ground there. And let me share this report from Richard Engel, if I can hit the right button. Bear with me just a second here. All right, here we go. So Richard Engel from Kabul showing you just the horrible situation that is unfolding right now as we speak.
We are now on the military side of Kabul International Airport. This is where those extra American forces have been brought in. They've been brought in to secure this facility while the evacuation takes place. And the evacuation is now moving ahead quite rapidly. Americans are being taken out. Foreign contractors are being taken out. Other foreign nationals are leaving, in addition to Afghans who are fortunate enough to have exit visas, to have visas to other countries. And many Afghans are complaining that that process is too slow. Around the edges of this base, around the perimeter, are many Afghans, thousands of Afghans who have no visas, who are trying to push their way in. And that is exactly what happened a few days ago. Thousands of Afghans climbed over the walls. They came into this base. They rushed onto the tarmac. They climbed into civilian planes. They climbed. They tried to climb onto military aircraft and were holding onto the undercarriage. And according to Afghan media, several Afghans were killed when they fell off of planes after they had taken off. The base now, however, is secure, and the evacuation flights are proceeding and proceeding quite quickly. In Kabul, a surprising admission, a senior Taliban leader telling NBC News that even they, the Taliban, were surprised at the rapid collapse of Kabul, that they didn't have the resources in place to take Kabul. They didn't expect that the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, was just going to up and leave, but they still managed to come in and take the city. The city is quiet. The city is tense. A lot of people are staying at home. But we are starting now to see the first signs of discontent, the first signs of protest. Yesterday, a very small group of brave Afghan women went out onto the streets to demand rights, to say that women's rights
are
under the Taliban rule. And then in Jalalabad today, a disturbing incident. Afghan demonstrators went out. They were carrying the old Afghan flag, saying that is their flag, not the new white Taliban flag. And according to witnesses, Taliban drove by in a vehicle and opened fire on that crowd, killing at least three of those demonstrators.
Killing at least three
of those. NBC News.
Wow.
Kabul.
Killing at least three of those demonstrators is what he said there. So the situation obviously is tense. It's bad. But the thing that's different from what our guest is going to tell us about is we're seeing the real-time reporting. Let me bring in David Potter. David Potter, again, is the author of the new book, Disruption, Why Things Change. David Potter is a professor of Greek and Roman history at the University of Michigan. He's written a lot of books on the subject. David Potter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, Nicole, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, your book, it tells about sea changes throughout history. I mean, and you go way back. I mean, when we talk history, you're going back to Constantine and the Christian church, Jesus and his followers. So you're going way back. And then you bring us all the way up to really present times, because the epilogue deals with what we're going through now. When I said, we watch this report, Richard Engel, we're seeing these events unfold in real time. This is a perspective that we never had on most of these changes throughout history that you cover in the book. Does this give you a different insight into it, or is it all just, the disruption that you're focusing on?
Well, I think that one of the things that comes out of the book, I hope, is how time works differently. Things move a lot faster for us now than they did in the past. And one of the things I think is very important about trying to think with history is that we can see patterns in the way that people interact with each other over time, which can give us an idea of what we're dealing with right now. I mean, I'm trying to use the past really as a way of thinking about the present.
Or makes me think of the saying, past is prologue. I mean, it gives you a basis for everything that is to come in the future. And so you have I'm not a history student. I mean, I was many, many years ago, but sadly, I guess it's a good thing I've been out of school for a long time. So a lot of this stuff I don't remember. I'm more a student of current events and what's happening now. So what's interesting about the book is the groundwork that's laid for how things change. Why things change is actually the subtitle of your book. So what we're living through now, let me ask you this, was this foretold in the history anywhere? Are we seeing history repeating itself, or is this all new? David, did I lose you? I think we lost David. Because he seems to be frozen there. Oops, we lost him. Hopefully he'll come back in, because our connection has been lost. Well, shit. All right. Well, David Potter, I hope he comes back in, because that's not good. He's back. All right. I don't know why he lost the connection. Let's bring him back in and see what happens there. I thought maybe I asked a really tough question. There you are. All right, we're back. David Potter, sorry we lost you for a moment there. Everything okay?
Yeah.
That was weird.
Yeah, no, we just had a power outage here.
Oh, Oh, you're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the power went out. Oh, interesting. Yeah. So now you're on your phone. You know, I'm in Florida. That kind of stuff usually happens here. We get power outages all the time, but okay. Is there a storm or something happening there, or just
no? I'm sitting in my office at the university, and the power just went down.
Oh my goodness!
Throughout the building.
Wow. Well, thank you for coming back in. Thank you. Another disruption. There you go. Thank you for coming back in so quickly. So I was asking if you know, is history repeating itself? Did you see this coming in some of the disruptions throughout history that caused change, or is this all new?
There's a lot of parallel, because I think what we see are people who in power who lose track of what can go wrong. I mean, the major disruptions that we look at in this book begin with a total loss of confidence in the central institutions of a society. And very often, the reason for that loss of confidence is a failure on the part of a government to realize just what exactly could go wrong. I mean, the Bolshevik Revolution, you know, comes about because the Tsar of Russia started a war despite the fact that he knew that his staff had told him they didn't have the artillery shells that they needed to fight the war. And we see other examples of this throughout time. When we look at the rise of Islam, and believe me, I don't think Muhammad would recognize anything that he taught in the behavior of the Taliban today, was conditioned, again, on the failure of governments and the Roman Empire and in Persia to actually understand the consequences for their people of the war that they'd fought, of the terrible plague that had smitten them. I mean, there are a lot of things that come back time and time again in history as destabilizing elements.
You know, it's interesting. You do bring up the Muhammad, the rise of Islam. Well, that is a whole chapter in the book. After the section on Christianity and Jesus, you go into the rise of Islam, then the Protestant Reformation, and on from there. Again, I've got a million questions, and they're all over the place. So I hope you don't mind. I'm a bit scattered. I think back to the Trump years. Thank God they're in the past. I hope they're in the past, because I'm not so sure. Just look at today. He's made so many statements. He frightens me. His followers frighten me even more. And I'm wondering, you know, Hitler rose with in a similar situation, didn't he? What are the parallels? We're seeing this rise of authoritarianism, not only here, but in Great Britain and in other places around the world. This, they call it populism. I don't think of him as a populist. I think of him as an authoritarian. But then again, I'm not a historian. I'm not a professor. What are the parallels here? And am I right to be worried?
I think that you're very right to be worried, because what we see is control of media by somebody who's convincing people of a big lie.
Yeah.
And what Hitler did was convince people that he was the solution to a series of problems. He was going to solve the problem of the Depression. He was going to solve the problem of the Versailles Treaty. He was going to deal with the treachery that had defeated Germany at the end of the war. There's a whole series of
your power's
of lies,
back.
And now we've got the power back. But you know, at exactly the same time, Stalin was behaving in exactly the same way in Russia. He was creating images of enemies, of outsiders, who would destroy the power of the revolution. And we go back further to another menace, Robespierre, in the French Revolution. And what enables all of these people to succeed is the collapse of the center politically, of the collapse of a collective sense of belief in agreed upon facts.
The collapse of the center. I've noticed that in your writing, and we're witnessing it now. And look, I'm proudly progressive. I have a problem with many of the centrist Democrats who I don't see as centrist at all. I see them as conservative Democrats. There seems to be no center in this country anymore. Should we take that as a warning sign?
I think absolutely. Because what we saw, for instance, in Germany is that people who weren't necessarily going to support Hitler had no other place to go. Huh. They saw it as a choice between the Nazis and the communists, and they felt that the Nazis were a safer bet. You know, after all, they were looking at Stalin's Russia at that point, and people were afraid of the consequences of a communist takeover. It didn't help, of course, that Stalin thought that Hitler was kind of an interesting guy and actually undermined the German communists. But it was this sort of sense of nowhere else to go.
Right. Wow. Really. And for many of the Trump followers, they feel that as well, because they've been told that we on the left, we're socialists. Now, the thing is, they are mischaracterizing what socialism is. They're equating it with Castro's Cuba, with communism, with authoritarianism. The kind of socialism we're talking about, the Bernie Sanders type of democratic socialism, is nothing of the sort. But this campaign of not only disinformation, but misinformation, intentionally misleading people, giving them, you know, false facts, and then they turn around and call the real stuff fake news. I call it opposite world. It's just a thing that I think we're living in, where up is down, in is out. Nothing makes sense. And they've got a big portion of the population believing the lies, not only the big lie, but all the lies surrounding it. This has a place in history as well?
It absolutely does. And it is the key to what is, you know, really a completely destructive sort of disruption. I mean, there are some kinds of disruptions which work out pretty well for people, that something needs to change.
Yeah.
But in a case like this, you know, where we see that, you know, a political party is being defined in terms of imaginary enemies and false facts, I mean, that's what underscores and begins to lead to a really dangerous disruption, because it prevents people who might disagree with each other but can still talk to each other,
right,
from having those conversations.
You know, I'm so glad you said that, because I've often said I'd happily debate and welcome people with differing opinions on the show. I'd have Republicans on to have a meaty, substantive debate. But if they won't stipulate to the facts, if they won't stipulate to the ground rules, grass is green, sky is blue, then I can't have a meaningful discussion with them, because they won't stipulate to the facts. That's the problem. There's almost no common ground. We're living in two separate realities, and that's why I can't have a conversation with any of those people. I have not found, there used to be reasonable Republicans. Today, there don't seem to be.
No, I think that's absolutely the case. And what you also see is the tendency on the part of the Republican Party just to purge people who won't buy the lie.
Right, right. You know, today I'm pulling audio for the show, for the news, and I see Trump is at it again. He was all over Fox with more lies. Did you know he said that? I won't play the the clips, because my audience, it's like fingernails on a blackboard to them. But he actually said that COVID was just about done when he left office. It was done. It was over. And now it's back, and they're calling it Delta. I mean, he's making shit up. The day that he left office, I think there were 4,300 deaths. I think yesterday there were like 900. It was far from over when he was in office. If anything, he made things worse, but he's lying about it. Then he's talking about the Taliban and his deal that he cut with them, which to me is inconceivable. I don't know, as a student of history or a professor of history, what you think about this deal he made with the Taliban. He went around the Afghan government, which was who we were supposedly working with, to negotiate with the Taliban, to invite them to be in the United States at Camp David, like on the anniversary of 9/11. This is just not norms. He's turned all the norms on their side where nothing makes sense. And yet he's telling you that he did it and it would have worked if we would have just let him keep doing it. It makes me a bit nuts because I feel like we're living in this alternate reality. What does that do to you, to somebody who studied history?
Well, it drives me crazy because when you see people reinventing the past as something that it wasn't, my whole business is trying to understand the past as it was.
Right.
Now, sometimes that involves understanding how people can warp the past for their own interests and how you rewrite the past as a way of destabilizing the present. And you know, what we often see is as well that ideologically driven movements lose their own direction to sustain their own power. Again, as I said, you know, Muhammad wouldn't recognize the Taliban today. What he was trying to do was to show people a new way of understanding God that would enable them to save their souls and go to paradise. And he didn't envision conquering the world. And jihad for Muhammad meant struggle, not holy war.
Wow.
You know, if an early Christian had come and encountered the Catholic Church of 1519, they wouldn't have known what they were seeing. You know, the idea that you would be using your ideology as a justification for the persecution of others.
Right.
A complete warping of the initial message.
Right. It's a perversion of what it started out as. Then, this must make you crazy. You look at, say, just take Texas, for example, and what they're doing to their history books. They've taken out any, under the guise of we're against critical race theory that primary school is teaching. They're taking out mentions of Martin Luther King. They're saying that slavery was just like another form of immigration. I mean, that stuff that what they're doing is horrendous. They are trying to rewrite history. Shouldn't there be a law against that?
There should be, or the law of the ballot box is what should stop that, is that people should say that a political party that is based on a lie.
Uh-oh. And I think we're losing David again. You know, the connection has been shaky for the last couple of minutes, and we seem to have lost him again. Oh, this is so frustrating. We are speaking with David Potter. He is a professor of Greek and Roman history. He's also the Arthur F. Thurnow Professor at the University of Michigan. He's based at the University of Michigan, and that's where we're still connected, but we seem just not to be able to connect here. The book, though, is called Disruption, Why Things Change, and it examines history. And the thing is, it ends with an epilogue. And the epilogue, I'm keeping him open here just in case he couldn't get back with us. The epilogue is, and now he appears to be gone. The epilogue is January 6th and beyond. And what's really fascinating, let me try to bring just my picture back for those watching on video so you don't have a million images of me. So the epilogue is January 6th, 2021. And I have so many things flagged here because he goes into not only the mob that invaded the Capitol, but he brings us back to the beginning of the 21st century, really. And, the book is about disruption. It's about the internet. It's about the rise of Amazon. It's about the tech industry, social media, the rise of internet shopping. And all of these things are disruptors. And then he segues into the war on terror in 2001. And all of these things bring us to where we are now. Let me read to you just a little bit of what he wrote about the effect of institutionalizing the fear of terror. This kind of goes back to the interview I did the other day with Spencer Ackerman, whose book is Rage of Terror, I believe it's called. Hold on. Reign of Terror. Sorry. I knew it was something different. Here's what he wrote. The effects of institutionalizing fear of terror has had the coincidental effect of militarizing the war on crime. The war on crime has a class rather than party affiliation. The phrase originated with the Democratic President Lyndon Johnson and continued as a war on drugs under the Republican Ronald Reagan and the Democrat Bill Clinton, culminating in the 1994 passage of the brutal crime bill. The criminals who are the enemy in this war are not white-collar workers. They are residents of inner-city America. An impact of the war on crime, which allows for the imposition of long prison sentences for drug-related and other nonviolent offenses, mostly on people of color and others who can't afford high-powered legal representation, is to deepen the divide between communities on the basis of wealth as well as race. Identifying areas with large non-white populations as being, quote, high crime areas contributes to the impoverishment of those communities when the dependence of educational and healthcare resources upon property values has created a vicious cycle whereby struggling neighborhoods, this goes on, cannot support the institutions that serve wealthier areas. It's all about disrupting the status quo. And I think we are in an era of such massive disruption, I think, from the internet. So, David is back with us. David, I've got your audio, so I'll get our shot together again. But, you know, I was mentioning the epilogue of the book, Disruption, Why Things Change, and how you bring it full circle to today. And you go back to really the rise of the internet. I've said a million times that, you know, it's like the internet, can't live with it, can't live without it. It made things so much better, but it made things so much worse, didn't it?
Well, absolutely. And I think that what we saw was an incredible period of creativity, which brought these new companies and these new technologies together and made them available. But we didn't start asking questions when we saw them changing. And, you know, again, this is a question of the speed with which things change. And so it seems to me that we could discover the internet. Hey, this is great. Email is wonderful. I can go look things up that I couldn't look things up. But then, you know, we found Amazon.
Right.
And we found a local bookstore here in Ann Arbor called Borders. Turned their internet business over to Amazon and found that it was eaten alive. That we have laws that limit expansion. We have antitrust regulation.
Well, we don't enforce it.
But we don't enforce it.
Right.
I mean, if we don't enforce our own laws, we are going to have exactly the problem that those laws were intended to suppress. And I think, you know, Irene Khan in the Federal Trade Commission, this is a move in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
The EU has been trying to limit the monopoly power of these giant tech companies. What we were talking about earlier, where people can find their own echo chambers to yell at each other in, is another feature of the rise of the internet. I don't think anybody could have foreseen this, but now that we see it, how do we deal with it?
I don't know. And I think that the pandemic and people all over the world being basically locked in for a matter of months at the low end, where they were online and able to find others who shared these conspiratorial views or, you know, tinfoil theories, connected. And it allowed this, you know, fringe craziness, QAnon, to spread to the point where it's a major faction and you know, the then president actually embraced it. I mean, this is crazy stuff. Do you think this could have happened without the rise of the internet?
I don't think that we could have seen January 6th without the rise of the internet. And I don't think that we could have seen the real violence that's growing up. You know, we saw it here in the state of Michigan, where people were plotting to kidnap
the governor. Yeah.
And we need to take this extremely seriously. It's not a sick joke. It is a really dangerous thing to have happening. And, you know, if we're losing track of our ability to create the space for a civil discourse,
Yes. Yes.
And that's the thing. You can't tell people to shut up. But what you can do is ask that if they're going to talk to each other, they do so in a place where multiple opinions can be heard.
Right. But the thing is, there are fewer and fewer of those places. Now, we're going to run, if you don't mind, a couple of minutes over. We're going to let the Progressive Voices Network go because it's top of the hour. But because we lost you, I just have a couple more questions for you. David Potter is with us. The book, Disruption, Why Things Change, is fascinating. And I you know, zeroed in on the epilogue because that brings us to where we are now. And your benefit of being able to look back at history. There's a great song by the Propeller Heads with Shirley Bassey called History Repeating, which I always think of because I think it does. We go in cycles. It's not, you know, verbatim, but it does repeat. And again, I see the rise of fascism going, and I see the internet pushing it. I see the vilification of the media by the government. Again, all this under Trump. I don't know if Joe Biden or the Democrats can turn it around because they're certainly not blameless or flawless here. They're just not evil and lying about everything to the point they are. But they're also not our saviors. They're not the ones who are going to ride in on the white horses and fix everything. Can we come back from this, do you think?
Well, I think we can, but it's going to take a lot of effort, and it's going to take a whole series of small steps and small successes. I mean, I do think that the passage of the infrastructure bill was an important step forward because for once, Republicans and Democrats were actually talking about something that would actually help the
people.
Average person yeah. in this country. Finding more things that people can get together and agree on, but for every step forward, we need to be aware that the events of the last couple of days are a huge setback. I mean, this failure of intelligence, the failure of responsibility that we've seen in Afghanistan across, inherited from Trump, but the Biden administration should have known better.
Yeah.
And if you don't listen to your own intelligence people, or you can't allow people to tell you the truth and listen to them, you can't build or rebuild the confidence that you need.
We had General Mark Milley just a couple hours ago say we saw nothing in the intelligence that said they would overrun the entire nation in 11 days. But yet, I just had Lucas Kuntz on, who's running for the Senate from Missouri, who's an Afghanistan and Iraq veteran. And I asked him, did you see this? He said, absolutely. We knew this was coming. You knew it. He was in the business of training. His job was training Afghan soldiers. And he said they just weren't getting it. They didn't know what they were doing. He saw it coming a mile away. Why couldn't our intelligence agency see it?
Because there is a tendency to tell the guy at the top what that person wants to hear. And you can meet a whole bunch of people like that in the pages of Disruption. It's a self-undermining act of government. It happens throughout history. You've got to be conscious of the risk that you're taking if you will not tell the truth.
Right.
I mean, the fact that the people who fix the helicopters for the Afghan army for all U.S. contractors, nobody noticed that. I find that a little hard to believe.
Right.
The most important thing that the Biden administration can do right now is take a really hard look at what went wrong, to admit that this was not what they expected, what they anticipated. And again, taking the blame for something bad can actually sometimes be a way forward.
Absolutely.
You're telling the truth.
Right. And you learn from your mistakes, hopefully. But there's one other thing that I believe is perhaps the biggest threat to our democracy, to the United States of America as we know it today. And I don't think anybody in the Democratic Party is taking it seriously enough. Or actually, the people at the top who could do something about it are not taking it seriously enough. And that's this assault on our voting rights. In, I believe, 41 states, Republican-led legislatures are pushing through this legislation that would allow the local government or the state government to take control over the local election apparatus if they don't like the outcome of it. And they can say this election was not above board. We're going to throw it out. We're going to choose our own electors and tell you who won. That's what they're doing, isn't it? Am I overstating that at all?
No, you're not overstating it at all. And again, it's part of this sort of lie that has infected the Republican Party since last summer. That if too many people vote, that's bad. They're all going to be the wrong people. They're not going to be real. This is total nonsense. But again, if a legislative body cannot sit there and say, you know, that nonsense is nonsense. There are a few other words I was going to use.
Right, you can. We're on the internet, so you can if you want to. But yeah.
Absolutely. This legislation on the basis of lie has got to stop. And ideally, the point of the separation of powers is that a court will step in and say, I'm sorry, this is a violation of the Voting Rights Act.
But the Voting Rights Act has been gutted by the Supreme Court, which has been packed by Donald Trump and two stolen seats.
Yeah. And so, again, the checks and balances that were built into the Constitution of the United States are being undermined.
Well, they're failing, I think, because Congress is supposed to have oversight. The legislative branch is supposed to have oversight over the executive. And what we learned during the two impeachments was there's no teeth there. They can't enforce the oversight. They can subpoena you, but the administration can go, screw you, I'm not showing up. And that's exactly what they did.
Yeah. And one of the things that the founders were most afraid of as they were developed was faction. And they foresaw that a democratic system that falls victim to faction is going to fail. They were looking at what we're seeing today as being the biggest threat to what they were creating. It's all over the Federalist Papers, of course, that democracy fails when the guardrails that are supposed to keep you going are knocked over. And I think we need to be very, very worried that this is what's happening.
Right. So what can we do? I mean, has there been an example throughout history of the people seeing what is happening? We're seeing history repeat itself. We're seeing the rise of Hitler again. And I know it sounds hyperbolic, but I don't believe it is. How do we stop it?
That's a really, really good question.
Yeah.
And what you saw in this country in the 1930s was a really good example of a really intelligent administration coming in that put the interests of the average person who was suffering from the depression first. The government saying we are the government for the people and we are here to do the people's work is a way of restoring faith in the government. But you've got to find a way to bring that together. I mean, you have, unfortunately, some terribly irresponsible people from Mitch McConnell
to Fox News. I mean, the media is a big part of it too, because they're spreading the lies.
Exactly. And it's a lot easier to point to cases where a society's gone off the rails with this happening. The first thing Lenin did in 1917 was shut down opposition newspapers because he knew there had to be one voice in the room and that was going to be his voice. What we have to do is keep pressing for integrity in government, integrity in communication, a government that will try to put the interests of the average person ahead of the interests of giant corporations. And, you know, where there's a will, I like to think that there's a way.
Well, the way
has happened in the past.
Right. The way would be if they can pass both of these infrastructure bills,
yep,
inject money into the economy, help the little guy who needs help, who has been shut out for at least a generation, while the tax cuts go to the billionaires. This would be a step in the right direction, right? It would make the little guy realize, oh, wow, they are doing something for me.
That's absolutely right. And I think that the combination of these two bills, of the immediate steps that the Biden administration took to extend relief, the COVID relief package, that this is really important. And I also think that people are going to see, the governor of Florida is a pretty good case in point.
I'm in Florida. Hello.
Yeah, I know. And okay, this guy has been lying
about everything,
and you're getting sick as a result of it.
Yep.
So if on the one hand, we can see positive movement in Washington, and on the other hand, people realizing, no, my mother died, my brother is sick, my kids are sick because of Ron DeSantis's lies, that this affects you today, that Greg Abbott in Texas, this affects you today.
Yep.
That I think the combination of the two will hopefully lead people to a very different place than they are. An understanding that believing lies kills you.
Yes. Yes. The book is Disruption. And you know what? We didn't even get into climate change, because there's a big disruptor as well. That will change everything. It already is. This book goes in so many different directions, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned from history. If I wouldn't get copyright violated by YouTube, I would go out with the propeller heads and Shirley Bassey's History Repeating. David Potter, thank you so much for a fascinating interview. I could keep picking your brain forever, because there's so much here. And I guess I should be grateful that you've confirmed my fears, but I should also be I'm also even more worried now that you have, that I'm not just being paranoid, that these are real threats. And everything is so precarious right now and could easily go away. History does repeat itself, and it can, and we're not immune to it.
That's absolutely right. The patterns of the past will show us what to look for in the future.
Wow. David Potter, thank you so much. What a wonderful, scary, but a substantive conversation. I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm sorry for all of the technical issues at our end.
Believe me, this is my world. I live with gremlins in my studio. This is another disruption, right? I've been in radio for 40 years. For the last, I don't know how many, I've been working from my home studio and trying to do it with, spit and bubble gum and making it work, because my industry is totally different than it was when I got into it 40 years ago. So it's, you're right. It is disruption, and that's why things change. And that's the one constant, is change. Things are going to change. We just have to try to make sure the change is as painless as possible and not let the bad guys win, which is easier said than done, right?
Yes, exactly.
David, thank you so much. What a great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right. And with that, we're done for the day. It's scary, right? It'll make your head explode. Just keep thinking about this stuff. Oh, my God. All right. With that, we're done. Tomorrow, Howie Klein will be here, and we'll get us even crazier about the politics of it all. Ay, ay, ay. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm just going to go. I'll see you tomorrow. Keep the faith. Be good. And call out the liars. All right? All right. See you tomorrow, everyone. Bye. You know what? I may as well just give you the news, because we're here, and I'll let it play out, because I do it, so why not share it? All right. I'll leave you with today's What's News, because I can. If I can hit the button. Come on, mouse. Where's my mouse? mouse doesn't want to go. Here we go.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
President Joe Biden has had no problem reversing policies that were instituted by the former guy. He even did some on his first day in office. But undoing the deal the orange one signed with the Taliban in February of 2020 had little wiggle room to get out. This according to National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. He answered questions in a press briefing on Tuesday, and he said renegotiating the agreement would have led to an onslaught of attacks on U.S. troops. Some of Trump's advisors have said that the 2020 agreement should not have been honored. But the orange guy went on the Fox channel Tuesday night, spoke to his friend Sean Hannity about the deal that he cut with the Taliban and its de facto leader, Abdul Ghani Baradar, who arrived in Afghanistan on Tuesday for the first time in more than a decade. He had been in jail until Donald Trump negotiated for his release.
We had a great deal. We worked on it very hard. Mike Pompeo, a brilliant guy, and many others worked on it endlessly. Meetings with the Taliban. Of course, you have to meet with the Taliban. They're the ones that you're negotiating with. I spoke on numerous occasions to the head of the Taliban, and we had a very strong conversation.
To who?
To Mullah Baradar, who is probably the top person. Now, nobody really knows who the top person is, but I would say that's probably the top person. But I had a very strong conversation. I also had a good conversation with him. We talked for a while after that. That was the primary point I was making, and he understood it.
And now Baradar is in charge. Wow. The United States is now focused on getting thousands of Afghans out who've helped us over the past 20 years. The Taliban have allegedly agreed to provide safe passage to the airport for civilians who can come to the U.S., but no one knows how long the group will stay cooperative and what actions they may take against people who remain in the country. Taliban leaders have said they will provide blanket amnesty for all of Afghanistan as they establish their new regime. But U.S. officials and some citizens, well, don't necessarily trust them. In the few days since the Taliban took control of Kabul, women have reportedly stayed indoors for fear of their safety. Democrats in charge of three Senate committees are vowing now to hold hearings on the U.S. military withdrawal, showing that the Biden administration is receiving very little cover from its allies in the Capitol. Stay tuned. So Congress is out on recess, but there's still work being done, including negotiations over police reform, one of the many pieces of legislation working its way through Congress. Now we learn that one of the biggest issues is no longer up for debate. That issue being qualified immunity. That's what shields police officers from civil liability when they do something wrong. It's remained one of the main points of contention in the police reform negotiations, and now it's being taken off the table. Why? Republicans have been firm that they have no interest in getting rid of qualified immunity. Then why bother? Moving on to COVID, what's bad is getting worse. And in Texas, the governor has tested positive for COVID-19. Governor Abbott, who is fully vaccinated, actually even got the third booster shot, says he's not experiencing any symptoms, but is isolating at the governor's mansion. Well, no wonder he's experiencing no symptoms. He got three shots, and now he's also getting a treatment of Regeneron, the monoclonal antibody treatment that the governor of Florida is shilling for. Seriously. I hope the sheen from DeSantis is beginning to fade as people get a glimpse of his mini Trump shtick. His latest is a doozy. DeSantis has been flying around the state in recent days promoting the drug Regeneron and setting up monoclonal antibody treatment sites in three different counties around the state. Note that the treatment is expensive. One treatment costs the government more than $1,000, while a vaccine costs about $25. And it's not very simple to administer either. It's done with an IV infusion. And no vaccines are offered at those sites. And of course, DeSantis's order banning mask mandates is in full effect. Huh? Well, now we know why he's doing this. His top political donor, a guy named Ken Griffin, the CEO of the Chicago-based hedge fund Citadel, has invested nearly $16 million in Regeneron Pharmaceutical. Of course he has. The same guy also donated almost $11 million to support DeSantis through his PAC. Follow the money. Meanwhile, today's the first day of school in Broward County, Florida. Now, on Tuesday, the Florida State Board of Education voted unanimously to, quote, take all legal steps to investigate and take action against the Alachua and Broward County school districts because they imposed mask mandates in violation of DeSantis's order banning them. And the board threatened again to penalize the counties by withholding state funds. The Biden administration has already said they would step in and make the districts whole. Unbelievable. And if you're sitting here bitching about having to wear a mask or being told to get vaccinated, check this out. New Zealand, the country that probably did the best in stopping the spread of COVID, is under lockdown again. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced Tuesday that her government was imposing a national lockdown. This after they confirmed the country's first COVID-19 case since February. One infection, and they're shutting down. Ardern said authorities assumed the infection was caused by the highly infectious Delta variant. The patient, an unvaccinated man, tested positive in Auckland, but had traveled around the country. Under this lockdown, people must stay home for 3 days. All businesses except those deemed essential, like supermarkets and pharmacies, must remain closed. The last time the country was under a level 4 lockdown was a year ago. One case and they shut it down. We could learn a thing or two from our New Zealand friends. Here at home, the TSA announced that it will extend the federal transportation mask mandate through January 18th. The policy had been scheduled to expire on September 13th. The FAA said on Tuesday that there have been more than 2,867 cases in which passengers have violated the mandate. The skies are not so friendly these days. And if all that's not enough, Tropical Storm Grace is headed toward Mexico today, threatening to bring with it hurricane force winds, deadly riptides, and up to a half foot of rain. Grace is expected to reach hurricane strength by Wednesday night and could strengthen even more by the time the center reaches the eastern Yucatan Peninsula. This is a storm that already passed over Haiti as that nation is trying to recover from the devastating 7.2 magnitude earthquake just the other day. Along the eastern coast of the United States, Tropical Depression Fred is expected to bring flash flooding to the Carolinas. And there are other disturbances threatening out in the Atlantic. And on the West Coast, a new wildfire exploded in California, tripling in size in one day. The Calder Fire, burning in El Dorado County, has already burned more than 30,000 acres and is 0% contained. I wish I had an upbeat story to leave you with, but I don't. This is life in 2021. I got the And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.